Tech Talk on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello, and a very warm welcome to Tech Talk from RNIB Connect Radio, first heard every Tuesday lunchtime at 1, Thursday evenings at 9, and Saturday tea time at 5. If you prefer a podcast, search for RNIB Tech Talk on your podcast provider of choice, or just ask your smart speaker to play the latest episode of RNIB Tech Talk. This is our opportunity to come together as a community and celebrate and challenge and question and learn about the world of technology from one another. And sometimes we even speak to an expert or two. And to help us in this quest, we need, of course, your correspondence, your emails, your voice notes. You can send that to techtalk@rnib.org.uk. Coming up this week as part of RNIB Connect Radio's 20th anniversary celebrations, we'll be taking a look back over the last 20 years of technology and beyond, far beyond, I assure you. We'll be talking about some of the technology, some of our old favourites, and maybe some technology that's best left in the past. So do stick around for all of that. Joining me this week, my co-host, Callum Stoneman. Welcome in, sir. How are you?
Yeah, I'm doing good. Yeah, it's going to be an interesting one this week.
Now, Callum, I've been having a bit of a ferret around, and I've managed to dredge up some of my old technology. I was thinking, you know, what's the oldest bit of technology that I actually own? I have got a 99-year-old upright piano in my living room, so that probably gets that
nice
prize.
Yeah.
But thinking about digital technology, I happened upon this sharp talking calculator from the 1980s. Here we are. There we go.
1, 2, 3, memory minus 6.
And all of that, yeah, yeah. And we used to have great fun with this at school. One of our little favourite things we used to do as a teacher was walking past, we used to press two buttons in quick succession that said,
clear off.
There you go. Simpler simpler times.
Simpler
there you
times.
Go.
Yeah,
ruder versions of that are available. Let's see, moving swiftly on. We've also got the Franklin Language Master. Now, somebody said to me the other day they think you might still be able to get this.
Ready.
And this was a dictionary, basically. Yeah. So it's covered in buttons. You've got a little dot on the F and the J. Very nice. And then you can search for words. So
R-A-D-I-O.
There you go. I've typed in radio. Press
radio. Radio. Working.
And he's looking it up
definition
now.
Definition. Radio, known plural, radios, sense 1, transmission or reception of signals using electromagnetic waves.
There you go. So what do you need all these AI voices for? What's wrong with that?
I know, that'd be great for your audiobook, wouldn't it?
Exactly, yeah. You
yeah,
can get on with
nothing
that
wrong with that.
And then last, but by no means least, this is a little bit newer. This would be circa, I think, about 2009. So just give me a second while this one starts up and see if you can identify this, Callum Stoneman.
The old Nokia sound. Yeah, I remember this.
Yeah, there you go. We're getting into your era now.
Yeah.
So this is an N86 smartphone. I mean, it was like before, you know, we had sort of accessible Android and iOS phones. You used to have to get files that were apps. Often there weren't apps for things, and you'd have to kind of plug it into your computer sometimes to get stuff onto it. But this was a little bit ahead of its time. It actually has an 8-megapixel camera, believe it or not. And I think it has even got Wi-Fi. And then what they did, the screen reader developer, you know, they were really ahead of their time, the Torx guys. They assigned one button as the Torx button. So you'd press that, followed by another key on the phone to make it do stuff. So, you know, check the battery status and things like that. So let's see.
Network 0 bars, battery 7 bars.
Yeah, it says battery 7 bars. It's got not a lot of SIM card going on with this, but it's a bit quiet, isn't it? But yeah, lovely little phone. Still like it. Not sure why I've still got it, but there we are. What's your oldest bit of tech, Callum?
I don't know about the oldest bit of tech that I actually still have. I remember Torx really well, though. I used to have a Nokia, N73, I think it was, before I got my iPhone. And that had talks on it, and that was brilliant at the time. I mean, it didn't. You had a web browser on these things as well. I know you were saying about apps, and you did have a web browser, but it was very basic. It was nothing like, say Safari or Chrome or whatever you've got now. It was
What was it? They used to call it WAP or something.
Something like that. And you just got a really slimmed down version of a website. You just got it just tried to give you the essentials. That was about it. And if you wanted to, I mean, I remember once going to Facebook.com on my Nokia phone just to try it out. And I think I'm surprised the thing didn't explode. It just couldn't
Ah,
handle
well, there you go. Well, when RNIB Connect Radio started in 2003, the phone of the time was the Nokia 6600. I think that was possibly one of my first Talks phones. It was also the year that the iTunes store launched, so that you could buy digital
Oh, of
music
course, yeah.
legally, because there was a lot of less than legal activity going on before then,
Yeah.
the old Napster and things like that. We also, in 2003, got WordPress, the platform on which many people published their website. Lots of websites now published on WordPress. That started in 2003.
Yeah, well, they say it's the backbone of the internet now, don't they? Is the sort of nickname for it, because there's that many websites that are powered and hosted by WordPress.
Indeed, and it meant that for the first time, really, you could go and make yourself a website without having to know all the complicated, HTML and all that stuff. We had the expansion of 3G technology for faster mobile connections, and now, of course, we're talking about 5G. It was Concorde's final flight in 2003, Callum. It was a big year, not least because that was the year RNIB Connect Radio, in its various forms, got started. So, stick around. We're going to be looking back at 20 years of technology and beyond. It's another Tech Talk. As we celebrate 20 years of the station coming on air in 2003, here at Tech Talk, we thought we'd take the opportunity to look back, get a bit nostalgic, and remember some of the technology, some of the accessible technology from the past, the technology that made a big difference in our lives, that changed everything, and maybe even ask the question, have we lost anything? Well, to help us in this endeavor, we are joined by an esteemed panel. Jackie Brown works with RNIB's Technology for Life team, is a published technology author, the former chair of the British Computer Association of the Blind, and that's the artist now known as Tavip. We're also joined by Madeline Bloom, who is also with RNIB's Technology for Life team and has in fact been with RNIB for 15 years, not quite as long as RNIB Connect Radio. Madeline is also a keen tech enthusiast, using technology for cooking, travel, and so many other things besides. And finally, James Bowden is RNIB's Braille Technical Officer. James has a background in software, natural language processing, and is an accomplished musician. Welcome all. We also have our co-hosts, Hubert Pavalkovich and Callum Stoneman. So a real cast of characters. Let's go around each of you, though, firstly, and I'm going to start with you, Jackie. What was the piece of accessible technology that first made a significant impact on your life? What was the first piece of accessible technology that really made a big impression on you?
It would be the Vincent workstation, which is a setup of a BBC computer made by Acorn. This is in the 80s when I worked as an audio typist. And it had a very crude sort of screen reader and a speech synthesizer known as the Braid. And I was able to use a program on the BBC called WordWise Plus, and that really impacted on my life completely. I was able to, read my own work that I had just typed into the BBC. It was just amazing. And I thought, I want more of this.
Madeline, how about you?
For me, now we're going a few years ahead. It was probably my first Nokia phone I have bought with speech, with Talks at the time, Nuance Talks. until then, I've used a lot of Nokia phones without speech somehow. But I think that was, for me, something that I thought was significant. I could finally text people and I didn't have to anymore guess what I'm texting. So that was something I thought, wow.
James Bowden.
Very similar to Jackie, actually. Mine was with the BBC microcomputer as well. It wasn't specifically a particular setup, but it was the Mimic speech synthesizer, which was the first synth which was, shall we say, more readily available. And by today's standard, it's very, very robotic, but it was a game changer in that we could read things back almost instantly.
Hubert, Callum, perhaps a little bit newer to technology, maybe? Do you remember any of those things? Any questions for our panel about any of those bits of retro tech?
I've got to say, I mean, should I say how old I was in 2003, or will that just upset everybody?
Have you heard of the BBC Micro, Acorn, some great names there? I mean, are you familiar with the idea that we used to have cheat sheets as blind people? We used to have to remember, didn't we, Madeline, like how to turn the ringtone off. You have to down five and write three times and all that stuff. Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
Wow. No, I mean, I have heard of the BBC Micro? I have heard of it in passing, but I have to say, I don't know anything about it. Certainly don't remember it. It's definitely before my time.
You've never lived, Callum.
Does any of this mean anything to you?
I've heard of the BBC Micro, actually, having never used it, but I have certainly heard of it because I've had many long chats in my student days with various people about technology, the new and the old school. So the name is definitely familiar to me, but not the use.
I remember kids who could see a bit, you know, used to play things like Pod and Frogger and some of the other supposedly educational games that were around in that era. And can you imagine, Hubert, using a mobile phone without a screen reader?
I actually did use mobile phones without screen readers before, not for texting, really. I thought that was a bit too tricky, but I did have an old Sony Ericsson once, which, yeah, you kind of had to memorize, like you say, press down three times, left five times. You know, I do remember them days, which I was lucky to make a phone call, never mind text messages.
So I'm keen to find out from each of you, what was the big sort of pivot moment? When did everything change? So you mentioned the piece of technology that for you personally made a big impression from your kind of earliest memories, but which piece of technology do you think really kind of upended things, really disrupted, made a massive difference? Let's come to Madeline first.
For me, that's got to be my smartphone. Doesn't matter which one. It's just a revolution of how I'm doing things. It's anything, online shopping, banking, things I needed help with before, or it was difficult and clunky on a PC, or, you know, things I can. I was one of those people that said, I don't need internet on my phone. I can just, you know, go along and do my emails when I get back home. Oh my God, I don't know why I said that, because I couldn't imagine a world without having instant access to everything I need to use. And I think that was, for me, the biggest revolution, really.
I remember doing email in the early 90s, and we used to send our emails, and then the college would go online in the middle of the night and send and receive all the emails. So it was like snail mail. You know, yeah. You used to get your email replies like the person you were receiving your message would get it the next day, and then you might get a reply the following day. So if you sent an email on a Monday lunchtime, you might get a reply on a Wednesday. And given the amount of email I received, that's probably still going to be the case. James Bowden.
For me, you mentioned I had a background in software and so on. For me, it's the Braille display, when I actually had access to both speech and Braille together. That really was quite revolutionary. You're reading these long, complicated lines of code sometimes and trying to count up all the brackets. There's one open, there's two open, oh, there's one closed, that means I've got one open. And you've got a syntax error somewhere. It was so, so, so much easier to read that all in Braille and just count them as you go along, rather than having to try and listen to the speech synth and you didn't quite catch it and it wasn't fast enough, or it was too fast, or whatever else, you know. So having it both speech and Braille together, that really was something special for me.
And Jackie, I know you're very enthusiastic about Braille and Braille displays. I mean, you literally wrote the book on the subject. But are there any other pieces of accessible technology that you think really changed everything for you?
For me, I agree with with James and Madeline, but the real game changer for me was talking teletext, because the idea of having, at the time, and you're going back to the early 90s, having CFAX, and it used to be Oracle for ITV at that time, but the idea of being able to get up-to-date football scores, you could leave it on the line where, you know, any scores coming in, it would read them out. So talking teletext would shout those out. I'm still very much a news junkie, and I used to do a lot of journalism stuff, and I found the talking teletext absolutely invaluable. Whenever there was a news story that I wanted to follow, I could just go into it, turn it on, and just, you know, wait for the news to pop up. It just, for me, it was just fabulous.
In the world before the internet, can you imagine that, Hubert and Callum? No internet. Imagine there's no online. And teletext, it was a bit like the red button.
Yeah, I mean, that's how I remember teletext. I do remember the early days of kind of, you would, you know, press the red button to see the latest offers and things like that. I remember that kind of thing coming up. Again, that would have been like early 2000s though. So probably, I imagine it worked differently to the way that you're talking about.
Yeah, it did actually. It was slightly different, because obviously you didn't have a TV screen. You had this lovely keypad that when you turned it on, it was very robotic, the synthesizer on it, but you turned it on, and then it would default to, you know, page 100 of whatever channel you were on. So you had a channel button that you could change to ITV. And then of course, well, channel 4 came along as well after that. So it was, It for me, it was just a game changer.
Now, James Bowden, you are one of these people that keeps old tech going for a while. You know, if it ain't broke, keep it going, put a bit of sticky tape around it. Or I think you were the last person that I knew who had dial-up internet. Do you think we've lost anything over the years?
Well, I've been thinking about this, and one thing I'm thinking that we might have lost is creativity. Back in the day, there were all sorts of crazy sort of things you shouldn't really do, but you could do with tech. I'm thinking, for example, do you remember old cassette recorders? And you could do things like push the pause button halfway down and make your tape play fast speed and all this kind of stuff. And you can't do that anymore.
Is there any particular piece of accessible technology that you wish was still around?
No, I don't think so. One thing I slightly miss is tactile clocks, but I've got one still, so it works. And as you say, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. It has had a couple of knocks in over the 30 years I've had it, but it still works. And just if you wake up in the middle of the night, you know, just reaching out and touching something and saying, oh yes, it's 2:15, I better go back to sleep then. It's much better than waking the whole place up, it's 2:15 a.m. or whatever.
Oh, yeah. Goodness me, yeah.
No, it's funny that you say that. When I first met my wife now, I used to have one of the old school, you know, talking watches like that, pretty robotic voice, and, you know, just used to shout the time out. There was no volume control, and I think if I hadn't have got a tactile watch, I don't know if we'd still be together now, to be honest.
That's great.
The secret to a happy marriage, a tactile watch.
She is sighted, and after spending even a couple of nights together, she was like, you need to get rid of that thing. I'm not having this.
Madeline.
I was one of those that I had a Braille watch for a long, long time before I started using other watches, smartwatches. And that was one of the reasons why I didn't want to let go of it, because I didn't want other people to know what the time is. So I'm really, really thankful to the feature of having vibrating time display on my watch and things like that. I really don't like everybody needs to know that I'm checking the time. No, I don't think we've lost anything. I think we have control about information around us. I remember 20 years ago, 10 years ago, I used to say things like, we don't have access to enough books. It's such a shame that not enough books are being transcribed. And I think right now, more than ever, I think we are a part of all the media around us, and it puts us very much on an even keel with everybody around us, which is quite good.
Do you think, though, Madeline, having so much stuff, and back in the day when we didn't have so much stuff, we had to be more creative about solving problems?
Definitely, and we had to be able to memorize all the telephone numbers that we knew.
Oh,
Where
yeah.
I don't know any number anymore, not even on my husband, so it's really
I still
bad.
know a few, yeah.
Yeah, a couple of numbers I know.
Yeah, I couldn't tell you anyone's telephone number now. Jackie, how about you? Is there a piece of technology that you wish was still around?
I've given this a lot of thought, and to be honest, I think we are so lucky. If there is ever a good time to be blind, I think it is in today's world, because we've got smart speakers, smartphones, smart watches. Well, I don't have one of those actually, but I still have a Braille watch, and I can still look at the time in the night on a Braille watch that I keep beside my bed. And I just think it's great, all these AI features that we're getting now, the Be My AI, being able to describe pictures, and me being able to talk to my grandsons on FaceTime or WhatsApp on a phone. I just absolutely love it. And I just know there isn't, while I miss talking teletext in the sense that, it was great, I could just leave it alone and it would announce a football score without having the radio on or anything. But that, it's been replaced by, news apps. You get news flashes. There is just so much out there now that I just totally welcome the whole thing. And the Braille is getting better as well. Braille displays, multi-line Braille readers, it's just fantastic.
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the trade-offs that it feels like we've made, particularly on phones, is battery life, right? Because those Nokias, which obviously did a lot less, I completely accept that, but they used to last a week.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember. I mean, I used to have I think it was an N73 Nokia phone with Talks on it, and I could go sometimes even 10 days without charging that thing up. It just ran. I mean, it's still. I had a look for it in preparation for doing this, and I can't find it. But I have a feeling that even if I could find it, it's probably in a drawer somewhere, maybe even at my old place. But even if I find it and turn it on, I bet it's still got a couple of bars of battery life left.
One thing I also noticed is cost. We used to have to pay out so much more money for technology
Yeah.
back in the days. And now, a lot of the times, we can get the same smartphones as everybody else. We don't need to pay any extra for the software that we use. It's quite good these days.
And it's at the same time as well. I think that's the big change, isn't it?
Yeah.
That we've got the accessibility out of the box at the same time. There's still lots of frontiers that need to be challenged, though. Still lots of work to do. And I'm just going to ask you, thinking ahead to our show on 2043, what your kind of hope, dream, wish would be for the future. Let's start with you, Jackie.
I think AI is inevitably, going to get more powerful. My only concern with that is you've got to sort out the fake stuff from, the real stuff. But I think the idea of having everything described to a blind person, photos, scenery, objects, things that you can't see ordinarily, I think that's really going to be a game changer. It's already starting to be, but I think it's going to become more powerful. And also access to more and more books, in being able to just download any book, or grab any book you fancy. There is still a long way to go where that's concerned. It's great that we have the RNIB Talking Book Service, the RNIB Download Service, we've got Kindle, but there is still a lot out there that we can't access, and it's all to do with copyright and things like that. I just think that in the future, that would just be that you could just say, oh, this book's being released today, going to grab that because it's accessible.
I sort of feel like you're right that AI will help us ingest lots of information in a short space of time. So, you might want to read a book and you'll be able to choose how much time you want to spend on reading that book. And then the AI will make you a half an hour version or a 90-minute version or, whatever time you have available. And the same with your email. Madeline, how about you?
I think I'm waiting for that futuristic robot guide dog to improve.
Yeah.
that sounds interesting. So that's one of those things. And for the rest, I'm all with Jackie about AI. It's a very, very powerful tool, enhancing a lot of independence again. So I think that now are my two areas I'm sort of waiting for development.
At the California State University Conference on Technology and Disability, Sony regularly pitch up with their robotic dog. It's not a guide dog, but it's meant to be a companion, you know, for people with, cognitive difficulties or to combat loneliness. And it's remarkably engaging. I really didn't want to like it, but I couldn't help myself, you know, just sort of tickling it under the chin
Same
and
here,
it was responding, you know, it was just unbelievable. James Bowen, are you going to keep sticking sellotape on everything, or are you hopeful that there's something better around the corner?
Two things could I say, perhaps. Is better braille displays. So they're still, you know, reasonable chunks of tech. Imagine having, for example, braille cells which are so thin they can just stick onto any kind of screen. Say you have a screen on your washing machine or your cooker, and you can just turn that into braille. That would be awesome. Or if you had a true graphical braille display. So we're beginning to get these multi-line braille displays, and they still have basically pins, and they can do text, and they can do dotty graphics, if you like. Imagine true line graphics with one of these things. That would be awesome. And the other thing, which we haven't mentioned, of course, is things like driverless cars.
Oh, yeah, we haven't mentioned that one. That's a good area.
Yeah, autonomous vehicles. And on the tactile tech, James, I wonder whether it will be the entertainment industry that might drive that. You know, if people want, you know, gaming or entertaining experiences to be more immersive. You know, it seems like there might need to be a kind of a mainstream use case to really make that viable.
Yeah, possibly. And it's interesting. We've seen, you know, various projects, you know, over the years saying, oh, we've got this tactile screen that goes on a mobile phone that uses XYZ technology. But we've not actually seen one come to market fully yet.
Okie doke. Right. Well, as we draw this discussion to a close, we will next week be talking a lot more about future tech and what we would hope is around in 20 years from now. Hubert, Callum, any final thoughts, questions, comments for our panel?
Well, I agree with James. I think braille displays is something that I'm looking forward to, because these multi-line braille displays, I mean, they do sound good and they do sound really promising, but I think you've got two main problems. The size of them, which is sort of unavoidable, I suppose, and also the price. You know, you've got the additional cost for all those extra pins and processing power and all this stuff to work. But these are early days. You know, it's early days of this sort of technology. And if we can get braille and tactile graphics more out there, more accessible, then that could be incredible.
For me, tactile graphics is just sounds like a really interesting concept, because, you know, it's all good to get your photo described, but can you imagine if you'd be able to feel a picture or an image or a diagram or something, you know, with using technology? I think that'd be quite fascinating and it'd be quite a unique experience.
Interesting thought to finish on. Jackie Brown, Madeline Bloom and James Bowden, thank you so much for joining us here on RNIB Connect Radio.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to our special episode of Tech Talk, celebrating 20 years of RNIB Connect Radio. And this week we're looking back at some of the older technology, not necessarily from 20 years ago. We don't really mind if it was a little bit earlier or a little bit later. But as it was 2003 that Connect Radio was launched, I thought I'd just give you a bit of a rundown of the type of technology that was out there at the time. What was new? What was released? What was trending? What were people using? And what was being talked about in the year 2003. Now, I can't promise that I'll cover everything, but there's a few things in here that might surprise you. There's a few inventions that are still being used today. Ah, the good old days of Windows XP and Internet Explorer. There's two things that haven't quite stood the test of time, have they? But sort of staying on the Microsoft theme, The messaging service Skype was released in 2003. That was released in August. And although the initial version of Skype was, I guess you could say, fairly basic, especially by today's standards, it only really allowed voice calling from PC to PC. But this was quite revolutionary at the time, where not long after its initial release, it then introduced calls to landlines. So using your computer, you could make a call to a landline, so it didn't matter if the person at the other end didn't have Skype or even didn't have the internet. You could make a phone call using the Skype program, and there was a fee. Obviously, you had to pay to make the call and to have a Skype number and things, but the benefit was that because the call was going through the internet rather than your traditional phone line, it was a lot cheaper, especially for international calls. So if you can imagine at the time how much a call to, I don't know, let's say from the UK to the US would cost, it would cost you an absolute fortune. And with Skype, yeah, okay, it would still cost, but it was a lot cheaper. And this was a huge benefit to everyone, you know, anyone who had family internationally or maybe had friends who were in another country. They could much easier and much, you know, keep in touch with them in a much more cheaper, cost-effective way. It was a phone call, so there was no video support, but it was a huge benefit, as I said, to people who had family and friends internationally and they wanted to keep in touch with, or even if you just wanted to keep in touch when you went on holiday. But there was also a huge benefit in the blind community and I guess the disability community as well, because there were, although social media wasn't as huge as it was then, there were things like, you know, there were visually impaired mailing lists and people wanted to connect to people. You know, you could communicate worldwide on these mailing lists and these other kind of chat rooms. But what if you wanted to actually connect to someone personally and give them a normal phone call, even if they were in another country? Well, from the launch of Skype, you could do that. And of course, for the disability community in particular, that type of connection is very important. It still is today, and it was back then. Obviously, the only difference was back then it wasn't as easily accessible. And Skype went a long way to changing that and to changing international communication, really. It's thanks to Skype that we now have things like FaceTime. You know, that Skype really kind of brought that out and showed that possibility. And Skype, of course, was bought by Microsoft in 2011, and is still going, don't know about going strong, certainly not in the accessibility side of things, but it is still used. Some businesses still use it. Of course, Microsoft are pushing people more to Teams, but Skype was the kind of kickstarter. Similarly, staying with communication, but in a slightly different way, the social media platform LinkedIn was also released in 2003, and that allowed people to highlight their careers, show off their professional skills, show off their certifications, and all these other things, and, you know, help them become more marketable and gain employment. Again, huge benefit for blind people there. Of course, we know there's all sorts of issues with unemployment. It's way below where it should be. There's problems with access to work. We know all that. But LinkedIn was a way to, well, and still is, again, because, you know, LinkedIn is still definitely going strong. And it's still a way to get yourself out there, to show what you've been doing, to show your achievements, to show your work experience, to show your educational experience. It's a fantastic platform. And back then, when accessibility wasn't really as well known, it was a fantastic way for blind people to, as I said, make themselves more marketable, show that we can thrive in the workplace. And LinkedIn is another platform that's bought by Microsoft a few years ago. They're into everything, aren't they, Microsoft? But that's another platform that was, they're still going strong, and that joined the world in 2003, so 20 years ago, the same age as our fantastic station. In terms of assistive technology, we saw the release of JAWS 4.5.1. That was the new version of JAWS at the time. We also saw the release of Window Eyes, if anyone remembers that. And in terms of Braille devices, we were using things like the PacMate PK, I believe it was called. All this is a little bit before my time, and information on these type of products is pretty limited, but hopefully someone who uses those would be able to tell us more. If you used these, if you remember it, do drop us an email or a voice message and let us know, because we'll be keeping this going. You know, this isn't just a conversation for this week. It's always quite nice to look back sometimes. And worth remembering as well that this release of Jaws and Window Eyes was all before the days of NVDA. You know, it was before there was a free screen reader available. So I imagine that new release of Jaws was very welcome. There's just a really quick look at some of the tech that was released in 2003. Of course, there was so much more. Talks for the Nokia phones. The Oasis 22C. Now, I actually remember this. This was my first phone. And it was a mobile phone that didn't have a screen. It was a phone specifically designed for the blind. All of its output was speech-based. It had your traditional, you know, T9 keypad. But, no screen. So if you were sighted, then you were a bit lost, which kind of flips the whole accessibility thing the other way around, really, doesn't it? So that was an interesting little bit of technology as well, which I actually remember. And I do remember quite liking it at the time. I don't think it'd go down too well nowadays, but that was the sort of assistive devices we had in terms of phones. I was going to say smartphones then, but nah, they weren't very smart. Phone calls and texts, and I suppose that's all you needed. So there you go. That's my really quick roundup of 2003 accessible technology.
Listening to RNIB Connect Radio, and on this special anniversary edition of Tech Talk, we are looking back at technology, and now we are going to look back at gaming. Joining me now are two blind and partially sighted gamers to help me reminisce about the great 20 years of gaming. Joining me first, you might recognize him as he is the Wobbly Gamer, Matthew Alcock. Hello and welcome.
Hello, and thank you for having me on.
And also joining us is Kim Jeffries, a fellow gamer. Kim, how are you?
I'm good, thanks, Hubert.
It's good to have you here. So let's talk gaming. Let's talk the last 20 years, shall we? Matthew, we're going to start with you. What is the first gaming device that you owned that opened up the world of gaming for you?
PlayStation 1 for me, as I'm 30, so I'm not quite the Nintendo 64 or the Dreamcast kind of generation. I am the second kind of line with the PlayStation 1. So that was my first console. I had a Game Boy as well. So I had a couple of consoles, like the generation 1 consoles from PlayStation, Nintendo. I didn't have an Xbox generation 1, but I did have the PlayStation. The PlayStation was 100% my first console that I really remember playing well.
And how accessible did you find it? How did you manage to play it with, you know, being partially sighted?
Well, at the time it was kind of, accessibility wasn't a thing, so you had to like it and lump it and kind of just get on with it and struggle, to put it bluntly. It was, you learned what you could play and what you couldn't play, to put it like that. It was, you kind of had to play what your vision was able to allow you to play at the time.
And we'll move on to you, Kim. What was the first gaming device you had?
Well, I started playing on like the really old family computer when I was about 3. So I used to go on like a train game and something to do with a castle. But my first like proper console was the DS Lite. So I got that for Christmas one year, and I was just obsessed with it, like Nintendogs, because I could actually see it. The brightness of the screen and the ability to adjust the screen brightness meant I could actually access a lot of it, because with the original DS, it was just impossible. It was just too dark. The same with a Game Boy. So we later got hold of a Game Boy Advance, and I couldn't see that at all. So yeah, the DS, one of the best consoles of all time.
And how accessible did you find the DS, or how did you work around to be able to play games on it?
I think the thing with the DS is, even though the screen is quite small, even on like the XL version, which I did get, it's optimized for the small screen. So the actual text size was quite big, especially in things like Pokemon, and I played a lot of that, and Animal Crossing. So it actually was easier being able to have the screen like right up to my face with the, you know, larger text on it. So I found it quite accessible. You know, as someone who's like partially sighted, got a bit decent useful vision for like reading. Yeah, it was good.
So we've talked gaming consoles. Now let's talk games themselves. And it could be potentially a tricky question for a passionate gamer, but I'm curious to hear from you on this. So Matthew, we'll go to you. Over the last 20 years, what was your favorite game to play? Or if you can't pick the favorite, or what was one of our favorites?
It's Oblivion for me. Whenever anyone says to me what's your favorite game, it was Oblivion. It's an open world RPG from Bethesda. And it just blew my mind as I must have been 13, maybe a bit younger. Just absolutely blew my mind. The open worldness of it, the customization, you built your own story, you created your own character. It was just, yeah, I still haven't had a game that I think has opened, mind the pun, opened my eyes as much as Oblivion has.
And if for people that don't know, is the game accessible?
It's not an accessible title, but at that point, there wasn't accessible titles massively. There weren't accessible games. So as again, like I said earlier, you kind of had to put up with it. And for me, having usable vision, I was able to. But it was just, like I said, it was one of them games where I made myself play it until I could work out how to play it. I spent a lot of time playing games, and over the first couple of hours, adjusting the way I play them to make them accessible to me. I learned little ways and things like that, like most gamers do, but I just have to do it a bit more with the vision. But Oblivion was the one that I could play for hours upon hours, and most of the time end up with a headache at the end of it because I played it for too much.
And the same question for you, Kim. What was your kind of standout game of the last 20 years?
I also put a lot of time into Oblivion, maybe like 1,000 hours, something like that. I've played it on different platforms. I actually found it very accessible just because, unlike a lot of games, the UI kind of scaled up and it could get quite big. So the contrast as well was good with the text on the menus. So coming from Morrowind that I could barely see at all, I found Oblivion was just amazing. Basically everything Matt said. My other favourite game of all time is Fire Emblem Three Houses. And that is not very accessible text-wise at all. It's tiny, but it's got voice acting for every single line in the game. And that was just amazing.
So we've talked games and gaming devices. Now let's talk gaming and accessibility. And over the last 20 years, accessibility and gaming was certainly a topic frequently talked about, but not always. Much has been done about it until recently. So what I want to ask you both is about a key development in gaming accessibility that you have seen over the last 20 years. And, why is it so important to you? So, Matthew, have you got one for us?
So I've been doing accessibility in video games for a number of years now. I think it's nearly 5 or 6 years I've been doing it. And the real shift for me was when The Last of Us 2 was released. I noticed massively in what I did part-time as an accessibility like advocate and consultant that when that game was released, video games companies listened and was like, oh my God, this game's going to be accessible to all, because there was totally blind players playing it. There was deaf players playing it. There was amputees playing it. There wasn't anyone excluded from playing it. It was a game for all and a game for everyone. It was incredible. And then here, like, that has now set the gold standard. It's shifted the whole industry for me. You saw an industry-wide shift of, oh my God, we can make games accessible for everyone. It's been done, and now we've got a target to set. Like, the target's been set, the bar's been set. And I think now games companies are starting to try and meet that target and meet the bar.
Kim, how about yourself?
I think something that stood out to me across games is dark mode. So I remember, like, you know, 20 years ago, everything was like glaring white with like black text on it. It used to give me headaches. And it was often the same in games, you know, not, you know, maybe good contrast, but a bit overwhelming. And then dark mode just became so popular. I don't even know when it happened, but, you know, suddenly games started to have, you know, options for UI. You know, they'd have like darker backgrounds naturally. You'd have like settings to adjust the brightness in game. And that just revolutionized it for me. You know, it was the difference between, you know, gaming for a few hours and having a horrible migraine the next day, or playing all day long and being okay. So even though it seems minor, dark mode has definitely like revolutionized my gaming.
It's whatever kind of whatever works for each person. And there are so many different accessibility tweaks that can sometimes make a world of difference to someone, even if they might be small to somebody else. So that is brilliant. So now to preview our 2043 Tech Talk episode, where we look into the future, I want to ask both of you, what would be, what are your future hopes for gaming accessibility over the next 20 years? Matthew, we'll start with you.
That it's put at the forefront of gaming, as well as everything else. It's not about forgetting about disabled gamers, it's about remembering us first. So when a game's created, we're not waiting to hear about accessibility features, or when a console's announced, we're not waiting to hear about accessibility features. It comes with the launch details. It comes when the game's announced, oh, this game will have these accessibility settings, and just making sure it's inclusive for all, and video games are inclusive for all.
And Kim, what would it be for you?
I just want a world where everyone just assumes that blind and partially sighted people do play games rather than the opposite, especially with the kind of segregation that goes on now. It's really annoying. So, you know, there are people out there who assume, you know, if you have an eye condition, it's just audio games and nothing else. But I want to play what everyone else is playing. I want to play Fire Emblem. I want to play like the new Animal Crossing. So, yeah, I just really like that kind of changing attitude where everyone just sees it as normal to just play the same games as everyone else, regardless of what your sight level is.
Fantastic. Well, thank you very much to both of you for reminiscing about gaming. Thank you very much, Kim, and thank you very much, Matthew Alcock, also known as the Wobbly Gamer.
Thanks to Hubert and the panel there. And if you want to get more information on accessible gaming, just go to the RNIB website, rnib.org.uk, and search on there for Design for Every Gamer.
Dolphin, are you listening? Are you listening? I am sending this song for you.
You're listening to RNIB Connect Radio, and throughout the month of September, we are celebrating 20 years young. RNIB Connect Radio, in its various guises, has been online and on air since 2003. And here on Tech Talk, we thought we'd take the opportunity to speak to somebody who has had a huge impact on the assistive technology industry in the UK, not least because I think he's probably the person that got me working in this field all those years ago. Dolphin, of course, is a household name. You'll know Dolphin from the Easy Reader app, where you can access your RNIB talking books and much more besides. Steve Bennett, a very warm welcome in to RNIB Tech Talk. Let's go back to the beginning then. Just if you would talk about Dolphin itself, how Dolphin got started, the story behind the company's mission, and how that's evolved over the years.
Well, thank you, Dave, and thank you for that lovely introduction. I'm sure I don't deserve that. Dolphin, I think, was started in 1986 by Paul Blenkhorn and Peter Diamond. Paul was working in academia, I think, in Birmingham, and put something together for a friend to make see if he could use DOS, so earlier stages of HAL. And then they saw that there was actually a commercial avenue for that. And he involved a more of a marketing guy called Peter Diamond. Peter was a New Zealander, a Kiwi. So they started Dolphin. And I think the name came because Peter was a scuba diver, and in his marketing, he felt it would be a nice, cuddly name to use, and he enjoyed swimming around dolphins. So in those early days, it was based here in Worcester, I think originally from Peter's house, and then it's just moved a couple of places, and we've been in the same place now for over 20 years.
So what first attracted you to working in Dolphin? I think I'm right. So was it the late 90s you joined the company?
So just a little snippet out, 2000. So I'd worked for years in what you can describe as bank security, cameras, fire alarms, burglar alarms, that type of thing. I enjoyed it, The bit that I didn't do is I wasn't doing much for people. What I wanted to do is what I think is called the self-actualization. I was missing that in my life, and I wanted to work for a company that made stuff, and they made stuff for better of people. So the then managing director of Dolphin was Noel Duffy, who's still here, works with us. And he asked me to come along and have a look, and I just instantly liked the idea. I liked what they did. I liked the ethos. And the ethos was, let's do the best we can. It wasn't all about profit. It was the people that owned the business worked in the business. And what their main motivation was to see people succeed, see them fill their potential. And I think that's a lot of that has continued, probably to the detriment of growing the company, but it attracts the right people for us.
What's kind of kept you there, Steve? I mean, you're looking to retire at the end of this month, so 23 years with Dolphin. What's made you stay all this time?
Lots of things. Some of the stuff I've already talked about, I found very fulfilling. On one of those visits, you said to me something that stuck in my mind. I've never repeated it to you, but I will now, which was, but for three people who created something called an off-screen model, that was Mike Hill, Doug Jeffrey, and Glenn Gordon in GW Micro Dolphin and Hent the Joyce at the time, many blind people would be basket weavers, physiotherapists, or piano tuners.
100%. I mean, screen readers, you know, changed everything, and particularly, you know, we were told in no uncertain terms in the early 90s that blind people would never use Windows. And we should probably add David Costishan to that list as well at Window Bridge. They were one of the pioneers in the early days. And we were just told that, no, Windows, it's just not going to be a thing for blind people. Forget it. And the people you've mentioned there said, actually, we'll see about that.
Absolutely, they did. And they all of those people, again, that's what you meet in the AT industry. You meet people who are extremely talented. Who are motivated by the things we've talked about. Obviously they need money, but they could earn so much money elsewhere. They're motivated by what they can do. And again, it's been very fulfilling professionally for me, far better than selling cameras at the back end of industrial estates.
Yeah. And sort of technologically, what do you think has been the biggest challenge during your tenure? Obviously, we've seen lots of change, the growth of the web, mobile, software as a service. Which one of those do you think has been the most disruptive?
In terms of challenge, it's always been the Windows environment and the security levels, and particularly in the browsers. We had to find a way to do that, and we had to employ the best people be able to actually make sure we could give access, and that was expensive, but we did that. But in terms of disruption, Steve Jobs' iPhone was just, in my mind, is the best thing that ever happened. And in what he did there, he came through with a platform and built the accessibility in from day one, and that was just a huge disruptor. That changed everything. That infrastructure that he created around the phone, not just a handset, was absolutely visionary.
Accessibility and inclusion, they've become, I suppose, a bit, I don't want to say trendy, but, you know, they've become much more significant and gained much more attention in recent years. And assistive technology, I think the perception of assistive technology has changed. What role do you think Dolphin has played in shaping that narrative?
I hope people will look at us and say that we were one of the first people to create a screen reader and open the eyes of people to actually be able to use the world technology to fill their potential. And that in terms of the screen reading, the magnification and the braille that we have, I hope that they would say that we've created an environment with our free Easy Reader apps that they can learn. They don't need they don't need to worry about an inaccessible book or a piece of paper. They can use our apps to actually reach their potential that way. I keep using those words, but it is really important to me. So I'd hope that they'd do that. There are still lots of challenges ahead. They never seem to get smaller, I have to say. They'll always exist because it's a fast-moving environment.
Yeah, let's talk about some of those then. You're about to sort of log off from Dolphin, but what challenges do you think lie ahead for Dolphin and the rest of the industry? You know, obviously a lot of chat around AI at the moment. We're talking about kiosks, so many things. What else is out there, do you think?
Yeah, so there's challenges for Dolphin. It would be to AI. I think that's mislabeled. It should be more machine learning. So the machine learning part of it, using the large language models, has a huge potential. And we need to bring that into a way that's useful. It's really easy to create features without a benefit. What we need to do is to bring those in. I'd like it so that you can talk to our software, and if that's where you want to input to it, and then it'll perform a function. It will give you the information, and that would be the same for things like kiosks. So the ones that was very pertinent at the moment is the ones on train stations. They're not accessible. It's not a big step to make those accessible, particularly when they're Windows environments, to make them so you can use a little keypad on there and you can use the touch screen, move your fingers apart, make it bigger, change the colors, so everybody can have a use of it. I think one of the shocks for people when we talk to them about this is they always ask, well, how many people are blind? And we say, well, look at it this way. How many people can't read text? All right. And then you're accompanying those. And it can be, you know, instead of the small percentage who are actually blind, it's up to 10%. All right. And if you look at it that way, you're servicing everybody in that group.
Look, Steve, as you retire from Dolphin, which technology are you most proud of, and what advice would you offer to the kind of next generation of assistive technology professionals coming through?
We have three product ranges, so I'll do a little bit of name checking here. So we have Supernova, Guide Connect, and Easy Reader, and I'm proud of them all. We make stuff at Dolphin for people. It's hard. It costs a lot of money. But they're all for different audiences, and they all, in their own way, allow people to reach their potential or to do things that they want. So I'm equally proud of all of those that we've made from scratch.
And what advice would you offer for people looking to get into this industry?
It's a smaller industry, all right. And I would say you can make a difference every single day, rather than being in a big company. And I would say, get along to them, get along to speak to Dolphin or any of the other companies, and tell them what you want to do, how you think you could change things. In my experience, they're really good listeners. All right. And then you can be involved.
Yeah. Listen is certainly what you've done, Steve. And I thank you for that. What are you planning to do with your retirement?
Do you know, I don't know, and that's quite exciting. So, as you know, I've got a motorbike I quite enjoy riding. I've got a new grandson, but I'm going to take a couple of months out, and I'm going to have to think about what I want to do, or if I want to do anything. So, I'm looking forward to that part.
Well, you don't live far away, so hopefully I'll see you around a little bit. Steve Bennett from Dolphin Computer Access, thank you.
Thank you so much, David.
That's it from Tech Talk this time. We hope you enjoyed our little look back at our reflections and memories of technology over the last 20 years and beyond. And of course, as if by magic, next week we will be gazing into the future and looking into our crystal balls, Callum Stoneman.
Didn't realise it was that sort of show.
There we are. So if you have a thought about where you would like technology to go in the next 20 years, what would you like it to do? Where are the big challenges? What are the frontiers that we need to conquer? What needs to be made accessible? Well, you need to be pretty quick on that email if you'd like us to share. Techtalk@rnib.org.uk. It's the usual email address. Techtalk@rnib.org.uk. Go now and send that email and we'll try and include it in next week's show. But for now, myself, Dave Williams and Callum Stoneman.
Bye for now.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
Clear off.